welcome to Change Surfer Radio. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of our radically democratic future.
I'm speaking with István Cicere-René, and he is professor of English at DePauw University. Where is DePauw?
It's in Greencastle, Indiana.
And he is one of the co-editors and founders of Science Fiction Studies, which is, without a doubt, the most serious science fiction journal in the world. It takes science fiction and its various ramifications very seriously, and a lot of very good scholars write criticism in it. I want to welcome you today. It's fun.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Tell us a little bit about how Science Fiction Studies got started.
Well, it started in the early 70s, and it was the brainchild of R.D. Mullen and Darko Suvin. Darko Suvin's name is probably familiar to most anyone who has studied science fiction. He's the author of Metamorphoses of Science Fiction. R.D. Mullen is probably less well known, but he was a scholar, an 18th century scholar, but also a scholar of the Pulps and Burroughs. And the two of them just decided in the mid-70s that science fiction was interesting from both a literary and sort of political, social, political, and theoretical point of view. And they began this journal together, and it migrated up to Montreal and spent many, many years up there. There were different editorial collaborations. And then eventually came back to Indiana, where R.D. Mullen, who was then an old man, took it on again. And we then formed an editorial collaborative. There are now... Mullen died a couple of years ago, but we still consider him our founder and kind of guiding spirit.
It must have been a pretty hard sell at first to convince folks to publish in a journal about science fiction, since science fiction in literary circles was considered paraliterature and not really very serious itself.
Well, you have to remember that this was in the mid-70s, when this kind of thing was a lot more exciting and a lot more acceptable. The people that Suvin and Mullen got to write for them were already people like Stanislaw Lem, Frederick Jameson. It was international from the beginning, so there were writers from Poland and Germany and Russia. So actually it was a very exciting, self-motivated, theoretically extremely sophisticated group. They saw this. Many of the writers were European or of European origin. And of course, science fiction or scientific fantasy has a much more acceptable literary tradition there than in the States, and that sort of set the tenor of the first few years before it became academically really acceptable in the United States.
The European political themes then often appear in the journal, the ideas of postmodernism, deconstruction, and so forth.
Originally, the journal was very closely associated with a kind of new left academic Marxism, not the activist new left, but in theory, and Frederick Jameson actually was a regular contributor for a long time. Over the years, as with the general sort of decline of popularity in academic circles of new left thinking, other kinds of theoretical interests came in. Feminism has always been a very, very important concern. Postmodernism has also been central, since it's so closely related to technological transformations in global culture. Deconstruction less so, because deconstruction doesn't take on the real world quite as much as science fiction usually does, but often we get some stimulating things in that vein. We're still publish a lot of different kinds of criticism, including very traditional reading, but postmodernism has a particular interest to us because science fiction is sort of a postmodern art.
The reason that I originally, I started reading science fiction when I was about five, so I don't know about originally, but one of the things that has kept me interested in science fiction over the years is the inklings of utopian possibilities in the background, and science fiction started very much more as a distinctly utopian literature. What made science fiction writers turn away from utopianism and towards often very dystopian or at least more muddled visions?
Well, you know, of course, that in the 20th century, dystopian visions started pretty early, and they were things like Zamyatin and then later Huxley and Orwell, and often they were written by folks who were very gifted writers, and also it's sometimes better to tell it's easier to tell a story, a thrilling yarn about a dystopia than about a utopia. But then I think
a lot of utopian fiction is actually about how boring they are,
how
the individual has to escape from.
Of course, that's one of the critiques of traditional depictions of utopia is that they're often written about by people who have no real sympathy with them, and so one of the challenges has always been how do you write a really interesting utopia, something that actually was being pursued in the Soviet Union in the 60s and the early 70s, where you had writers who were influenced by Marxism in ways that they didn't want to give up some of the basic values and visions, but they wanted to imagine it differently than the way it was supposedly being practiced. But I think also just simply as technology saturates everyday life and representations more and more, folks, and including science fiction writers, get more and more the feeling that they are being swept along by a tide of historical changes that they don't understand and they'll never get control of. And that translates politically into dystopian feeling.
William Gibson's short story, The Gernsback Continuum, is thought by some scholars to reflect a feeling of the cyberpunks that pre-World War II science fiction contributed in some way to the rise of fascism and Stalinism. Do you think that the very mechanistic and militaristic visions of utopia, for instance, in Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy, had an influence in terms of people's thinking that a completely ordered and bureaucratic society would be preferable?
Wow, that's a... You want me to answer that?
I don't want you to blame fascism on science fiction, but...
I don't know. It's sort of a brilliant move on the part of the cyberpunks, and not just them. Around the same time, some social historians started to study what basically was, I don't even know what it's called, but sort of the futures of the past, or the past's tomorrows, when it became really obvious that every vision of the future somehow is a projection of the particular present in which it's being imagined. And the cyberpunks picked that up, and in the Gernsback Continuum you got a sort of classic version of that. I'm not sure how much we want to hold them responsible for political theory. It's a wonderful kind of game. Now, as far as looking backward, I think it has to do probably less with science fiction writers themselves than with the kind of science fiction that saturates political ideology when it's trying to transform a society, and that could be Soviet kind of fantasy science mythology of the early revolutionary period, but it could be, you know, England, post-war England with its very dreary bureaucracy that's still being driven by socialist ideals. So I think probably we shouldn't blame the writers so much as look to how much of the kinds of things that they're writing about are, you know, just sort of circulating through the social imagination.
Since World War II, a lot of science fiction writing Maybe Heinlein is an exemplar of an early example of this, but many others since has been focused on a kind of individualist, with the cyberpunks often cowboy-like individualism, fighting against various corporate bureaucratic authoritarianisms. And that's partly, as you say, a plot device, a way to create a dynamic tension. But do you think it also reflects part of the political zeitgeist? Is science fiction in that way reflective of a decline of left, the currency of left ideology?
Well, the kind of science fiction that you're describing may well be. I don't think there's anything inherently non-science fictional about left thinking or progressive thinking. I just think the moment the conditions haven't been right for it, the market has clearly been very unsympathetic to that kind of stuff. There are plot or literary devices that lend themselves to individualist constructions, formulaic stuff. But it's clear that in the United States, individualism has, and science fiction have been connected, almost maybe through an idea that I keep calling the handyman, the kind of Robinson Crusoe image of an individual who, if he's got usually a man, more than usually a man, who's got a lot of know-how, a lot of personal courage, can sort of create his own world and solve all the problems. And science fiction has clearly been, sympathetic to that.
Batman, MacGyver.
Yeah.
Everybody's
sure.
Got a lab.
The handyman hero who's, this is, you could say this is gadget science fiction. Mm-hmm. Cyberpunks are a little different. I think cyberpunk, not all of it, but a lot of it has been misread. The idea of the cowboy hero, that's more out of movies than it is out of Gibson. Gibson's cowboy is not a sympathetic character, and I think we get the feeling that's one of the great cases I believe of sort of misunderstanding. A lot of people who read Neuromancer, for instance, really thought of it as a kind of utopian vision of the hacker ecstasy. But even though there's a bit of that, I think actually it's much more dystopian, and a lot of it has to do with Case being kind of detached from any kind of collective world.
Mm-hmm. Now, to talk about science fiction really is a bit of a misnomer, because there are 10 different subgenres, and then there's a huge gap between film and television science fiction and written science fiction.
There certainly is.
And can you talk a bit about the ways in which popular film, for instance, say the Star Wars frenzy, reflects different themes, or is different in some way than the written genres?
Well, this is sort of a tender topic for me, because I really have no patience personally with Star Wars. But I find as a teacher that sometimes I simply can't express that, and I really shouldn't. I think Star Wars must be somehow psychologically useful for 10 and 11 year olds, or even younger. The every new installment seems to speak to a younger mind, but I just don't see any kind of anything other than a fairly crude kind of escapism. I love escapism as long as my mind is engaged. So I think actually in film, one of the problems is that because they're produced by studios for the most part, there's so much market analysis done beforehand, self-censorship, that the power of special effects, special effects lobby, you might say, it's very, very hard to get a thoughtful, certainly a critical work of science fiction. And even if you get something like Matrix, which has supposedly a critical point of view, it ultimately, you take a step back from it, there's no real criticism there. That's just a kind of illusion.
It's bad to be enslaved by machines.
Yeah, it's bad to be enslaved by machines, but it's great to be liberated by a savior.
Yeah, what, one savior in particular?
Yeah.
Just a couple guys with guns.
The one.
Maybe. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the many people see a Christian subtext to that.
Well, film. I mean, that's almost dignifying it. I love the film, by the way, and I teach it a lot, but on a certain level, you know, to say that it has a Christian subtext, I mean, I think it's ripping Christianity off at this point.
What is postmodernism, and is there such a thing as postmodern science fiction?
Well, there's a good deal of debate about that, of course, and a lot of it is charged by, people arguing very sophisticated theory about their tastes. At science fiction studies, we had to sort of come up with our own theory because when you're dealing with science fiction, it's really different than when you're dealing with contemporary architecture or popular culture. Well, it's sort of strange to say that, but since we take science fiction as a genre of theoretical, you know, different kinds of thoughts and approaches to the world, it's not always popular. Well, I'm not sure where to go with that.
Well, you came up with the
postmodernism. That's right. I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Yeah.
So anyway,
that may be a metaphor
our
for the
view, sort of an institutional view, is that postmodern culture is, or that dimension of culture where social practices and daily life and sort of the general cultural representations are completely influenced by high technology, particularly communications and transportation technologies. So the globalism, the collapse of global differences, cultural differences, or even the saturation of social life with television or computers or things like this. All of these things, as they produce cultural stuff, that would be postmodernist or postmodernism. As far as postmodern science fiction, yeah, there's stuff that would fit a literary description of postmodern science fiction, but it's tough. Some people think Neuromancer and Gibson is postmodern because he's writing about a world that's like the quintessence of postmodernism. At the same time, he writes in a very modernist style.
So a nonlinear writing style is what's considered literary postmodernism.
Well, that might be part of it. I'm not sure that nonlinear. You might be right, but something like Vert by Jeff Noon, mm-hmm. A Manchester writer from the UK, where a lot of the normal distinctions between fantasy and dream and science and social criticism sort of flow into each other. That would be postmodern science fiction. It could also be, and this might be something that you're headed to, and might also be considered slipstream writing, mm-hmm. and it's real hard sometimes to tell the difference.
Slipstream being the overlapping of various genres.
Well, actually, it would be the use of devices and ideas and techniques that were used to be characteristic of science fiction, but flow into even realistic, semi-realistic, or surrealistic visions of the present.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Pynchon, like Gravity's Rainbow, although clearly not science fiction, is so science fictional in some respects that Bruce Sterling, who coined the phrase, would categorize it as slipstream.
Right. So some techno-thrillers like that.
Well, I think some of it, I think there's actually a sense that slipstream writing is more dangerous and more ambitious than a techno thriller. That it actually does make people look at contemporary society in a way they never did before.
Mm. Yeah, Linda Nagata, I recently interviewed. I'm about to interview, and she considers herself slipstream. She writes a lot about nanotech.
Right. Well, now nanotech is like a natural science fiction theme, and I think one of the things we have to look at, what we get to look at all the time, is the ways in which the stuff that's being discussed as normal science or the science that gets sort of trickles down into social life, that used to be the line between science fiction and that stuff used to be much more hard and fast than it really is. There are a lot of serious scholars or scientists, research scientists, and working with nanotechnology, who, as they're just writing their normal stuff, write things that we consider indistinguishable from science fiction.
Okay, so my final big set of ball of questions to throw at you is about how the nanotech in particular, and also genetic engineering and the biological revolution, is beginning to filter into science fiction. Because one of the things coming out of bioethics, as I have, that's always been fascinating to me is the blinkers that science fiction writers, sometimes consciously and sometimes unconsciously, put on their imaginations about the way that humanity itself will change in the future. So, you know, if you look at Star Trek, 400 years in the future, we have the ability to dematerialize ourselves, rematerialize ourselves, make food out of thin air. But no one ever thinks, hey, why don't I just download myself every day? And then if I get killed out there in the battlefield, I won't really be dead. I can just boot up my backup, you know.
Right.
Or they never, people actually get killed. You know, why don't they have impervious bodies? Why don't they have four arms? They can obviously do all these things.
Yeah.
And so do you begin to see science fiction writers no longer hewing to that old H.G. Wells maxim that you can have a sympathetic character in a strange environment or a strange character in a sympathetic environment, but you can't have both?
Yeah. Well, you know, you're raising a question that I think most ambitious and artistically serious science fiction writers have posed to themselves every time they sit down to work out an idea. I think part of what you're talking about is the Frankenstein barrier, something that George Slusser, who's an important scholar of science fiction, but probably others even before him, used the Frankenstein barrier, that if you cross that, then in your transformation of humanity, then you're going to be calling down the wrath of the gods. That's still very strong. Of course, it's very strong in popular and mass culture. I think for a very understandable reason, as technology is administered to most people, and the bigger the tech, the more total the administration seems to be, and the less individuals or families or, you know, groups, social groups, are actually in control of their lives from that vision. So I understand and I'm sympathetic with, say, an honest sense of fear about technological innovation. But at the same time, you know, I'm reminded of something in one of the novels by the Strugatsky brothers, who were the preeminent writers of science fiction in the Soviet Union, in which they, the narrator talks about giving a writing class three wishes. And the only, of course, the only stipulation is that you can't wish for any more wishes. And the big surprise is how limited their wishes are. They could wish for world peace. They could wish for, you know, universal happiness. They could wish for things for other, you know, for the entirety of the species and the universe, but they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly one of the problems in science fiction is extending the imagination to, you know, to cover all its possibilities. At the same time, it's popular, interesting narrative with all these changes is an incredible challenge,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be real hard to get the concept people to go along with it, because practically every idea you have about what's plausible human behavior is being challenged.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the criticisms that people make of nanotech-influenced science fiction is that it becomes a deus ex machina, because if everything's possible, it's just magic. You know?
Right. Well, I've actually called it the twinkle dust, the fairy dust. And many science fiction writers actually who know a lot about nanotech decide that as far as their writing is concerned, that's what they're going to have to do, and they're even semi-ironic about it.
Mm-hmm.
There is a genre that we refer to sometimes as nanopunk, in which you have your basic cyberpunk story, but It's nanotechnology that's creating the strange universe rather than computers. And I think you're right. It's very hard to imagine what kind of real constraints there are on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really want to thank you for coming on today. Tell us how people can find you on the web.
Okay, well, we've got, actually, good that you say that, because we've got a website that we are very, very proud of. It's a really nice website. I'll give it the address first. It's www.uiowa.edu/SFS. It has all the reviews of that Science Fiction Studies has ever published. There's a one-year blackout only, so there's a lot of reviews there, and we have abstracts of every article that we've ever published, as well as a lot of other features. And the you can just click on subscriptions if you go to the website, or you can subscribe, and our address would be to Arthur B. Evans, DePauw University, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. And the subscription rate is $20 for 1 year or $35 for 2 years.
Great. Well, I really want to thank you for coming on. I've been talking with István Csicseri-Róné. He's a professor of English at DePauw and the co-editor of Science Fiction Studies. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS FM at the University of Connecticut in Storrs. If you want to learn more about radical democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about this show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. Also, check out past and future shows and myriad relevant links at the website, www.changesurfer.com.